From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Nathaniel Kahn talks about his new documentary, My Architect. It examines the legacy of his father, the late architect Louis Kahn, and looks into his father's secret family life. Louis Kahn had one child with his wife. He had two other children out of wedlock with women he worked with. Nathaniel is one of those children. He was 11 when his father died in 1974. After weeks of documenting Ground Zero and the removal of the remains of the World Trade Center, photographer Joel Meyerowitz resumed work on a project photographing a place whose natural beauty was the opposite of the destruction he'd witnessed. We'll talk about his new book, Tuscany, Inside the Light. And Ken Tucker listens to two new projects from Raoul Malo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. By a voice vote with only five senators present, the Senate gave final passage today to an $87.5 billion emergency spending bill that President Bush requested for military operations and construction in Iraq and Afghanistan. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Four senators said aye and one said no on final passage of the biggest supplemental spending bill in U.S. history. Just before the voice vote, Alaska Republican Ted Stevens urged approval.
The rebuilding of a nation and the recovery of the Iraqi people will take time. And we've got to provide the Iraqi people with time to heal and the resources and tools to create a new nation.
Senate Democrats, including Vermont's Patrick Leahy, clearly remain skeptical about the bill.
Congress is about to send around $70 billion to Iraq, where there's no functioning government, very little accountability, very few financial controls. Now that's a recipe for mischief.
The final version of the bill lacked the loans for Iraq reconstruction approved by the Senate. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
American troops in Iraq are searching for portable surface-to-air missiles of the type believed to have shot down a U.S. military helicopter yesterday. That attack left 16 Americans dead and 20 hurt. Most of the injured soldiers are being treated at a military hospital in Germany. Dr. Rhonda Cornum says the soldiers have a range of injuries.
As with any airplane accident, a lot of broken bones, a lot of compressions, loss of consciousness from being knocked around. Some of their injuries certainly are able to walk around, so I would say that some of them will be able to leave very quickly.
Dr. Rhonda Cornum, the commander of the American military hospital at Landstuhl, Germany. Most of the soldiers aboard the Chinook helicopter were on their way out of Iraq for leave. Saudi police say they've foiled a terror plot in the holy city of Mecca today. They say they killed two militants in a shootout. NPR's Kate Seeley reports.
According to Saudi officials, the shootout started after police surrounded a building occupied by the militants. They began attacking security forces using automatic rifles and hand grenades. Police fired back as the militants tried to flee, hitting one car and killing two of its occupants. Several others escaped. Police later discovered a large cache of weapons, including AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades. The Saudi government has been battling Islamic militants after a series of suicide bombings in the capital Riyadh last May. Saudi police say they will increase security in Mecca, especially during the last days of Ramadan, when some 2 million pilgrims are expected to visit. Kate Seeley, NPR News.
In stocks, the Dow gained 57 to close at 9,858. The Nasdaq was up 35 to close at 1967. This is NPR News. Fire officials in Southern California say they hope to have nearly all the devastating wildfires in the region contained by tomorrow. They've been helped by rain and snow that kept the fires from spreading. Officials say the Simi fire has already been surrounded, and they expect to contain the giant cedar fire in San Diego County sometime today. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, described as Russia's richest man, has resigned as the head of the Russian oil giant Yukos. The announcement comes a week after he was jailed on charges of fraud and tax evasion. Meanwhile, in Belgium, his attorney is denouncing Moscow for arresting his client. Douglas Baxton reports.
Robert Amsterdam, senior partner of the Toronto law firm Amsterdam and Peroff, told a news briefing in Brussels that there is a cancer of authoritarianism growing on the Russian body politic. He said this cancer includes a total disregard for the rule of law and the most aggressive attack on the legal profession that Russia has witnessed in many years. Attorney Amsterdam was in Brussels to lobby European Union officials about the situation of the former head of Yukos, Russia's largest oil firm, ahead of an EU-Russian summit with President Vladimir Putin in Rome Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
The Supreme Court has refused to consider an appeal to restore a controversial Ten Commandments monument to the Alabama Supreme Court building. And the appeal was made by Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, who has since been suspended. Moore installed a 2.5-ton granite monument to the Ten Commandments and refused to obey a federal judge's order to remove it. And the federal court said Moore's display violated the constitutional separation of church and state. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, working to end poverty, build self-sufficiency, and spread human dignity throughout the world. AJWS.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nathaniel Kahn, is the son of the famous architect Louis Kahn, but it was not a traditional father-son relationship. As Nathaniel explains in his new documentary, My Architect, Louis Kahn had three families. The architect and his wife, Esther, had a daughter, but Kahn also had two other children out of wedlock with women he worked with. One of those women, Harriet Pattison, is Nathaniel's mother. Louis Kahn, who was in his 60s when Nathaniel was born, visited Nathaniel's house regularly, but never lived there. The architect was found dead in a Penn Station restroom at the age of 73 in 1974. Nathaniel was 11 at the time. In the new documentary, Nathaniel tries to make sense of his father's secret family life and to examine his achievements as an architect. Some of the buildings designed by Louis Kahn include the Salk Institute in La Jolla, the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth, and the National Assembly Building of Bangladesh in the capital, Dhaka. The film My Architect opens next week in New York and Philadelphia and will open in other cities in the following weeks. I asked Nathaniel Kahn what distinguished his father as an architect.
He returned a sense of weight and kind of primitive power to architecture. And I think so much of architecture, modern architecture, had become very light, glass, steel, about skyscrapers. And Lou was interested ultimately in buildings that would be around and that would last and would be spiritual. And certainly he was interested in materials, very much in materials, and ancient materials, and heavy materials, brick, concrete, not so much about glass and steel. Very much about really creating modern buildings that have the feel and presence of ancient ruins. And I think people find that his buildings are not only intensely spiritual experiences, but they also work for what they were planned to do. So the Salk Institute for Biological Studies is a really good laboratory. It works as a laboratory. The Exeter Library in New Hampshire is a strange, mysterious building, but it also works as a library.
Before making this movie, what was your father's place in your world? Let's start with growing up, for instance. Your father died when you were 11.
Yes.
What was his place in your world when you were growing up?
My experience of him was very mysterious. He sort of floated in and out of our lives. I would see him maybe once a week, something like that. But yes, he would show up around dinner time. But it was you could never set your watch by Lou. He would just kind of show up at some point. And he'd usually call at the last minute and say he was going to come to the house. And my mother would go into a flurry of activity, making, a special meal. And it was a very, very exciting thing. And I always felt as a kid, I'm the luckiest guy around because my father is an exciting thing. He's not just a dad who falls asleep on the couch and watches TV. This is an artist who takes time out to come and, show up in our lives and is somehow almost a magical person, like Merlin, he was already really, an older man, though he had a tremendous boyish kind of energy and quality. But he was also very warm. I mean, he'd show up in our house, and it was a tremendous amount of fun, and then he'd disappear. We'd actually drive him back downtown to Philadelphia and leave him off at his wife's house. So
he was married.
Yes.
He and his wife had a child.
Yes.
He had two other children, you.
Yes.
And he also had a relationship with the architect, Ann Ting, and had a daughter with her.
That's right.
So he had kind of three families, one official, mm-hmm. two unofficial.
Yes, right.
Were you supposed to be a secret? Did other people in his life know about you And were you allowed to tell your friends and even your teachers that this famous architect was your dad?
Sure, I was allowed to. I think it was a kind of secret. Maybe it was an open secret. I mean, I think people who were close to him certainly knew these things. But he never went out of his way to tell people, you know, this is my my alternative family, these are my three children. That just never happened. We did not cross paths, you know. But I was a kind of secret, yes. And it was always a little bit difficult. People would say, you know, where's your father or who's your father? I was always very proud of him, tremendously proud of him. But I also, it always gave me a start, you know, in my stomach when somebody asked me that as a kid. Because I knew that there would be an explanation that I would have to,
really complicated.
Yeah, it was complicated.
Yeah.
And at that time, that was sort of a bigger deal. Now it's much more commonplace. But it was complicated also by the fact that he was a famous man. And I knew that, you know.
Did you call him Dad?
I called him Daddy. Mm-hmm.
And that was okay with him?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he was very... this is part of the conflict and part of making the film that is still something that's rattling around in my head, is that this was a man who was full of contradictions. He wasn't one of these workaholics who absolutely, you know, really had no interest in family or in children. He had tremendous interest in everything he was involved with. And I think that's the abiding contradiction of my father for me, is that I know he wanted to be a good father. He just couldn't do it.
My guest is Nathaniel Kahn, and his new film is a documentary about his father, the late architect, Louis Kahn. Let's talk a little bit about the circumstances behind your birth.
Sure.
Your father was already married.
Yes.
When you were conceived.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother, how did she know your father?
My mother was introduced to him. She was living in Philadelphia, introduced to him, and I think fell in love with him instantly, though she was 28 years younger than he. And I think that it was a love affair that lasted until the end of his life, you know, which was only really about 12 years. They met in around 1960, so when he died in 74, so 14 years. And she was very much, you know, she was an artistic person, was interested in landscape architecture, went back to school, actually, after meeting him to become a landscape architect. And I think it was a tremendous kind of flowering of her life to meet this man who was interested in her, who was older than she, and with whom she could share such tremendous kind of artistic connection.
What are some of the things she went through when she realized that she was pregnant, that he was not going to leave his wife to marry her? Abortion wasn't yet legal.
Right. True.
Having a child out of wedlock was still considered a very damaging thing. I mean, something that was going to kind of ruin your future in every way and embarrass everybody who was connected with you. So what are some of the things that you know that she went through when she was carrying you?
I'm here because of her courage. I think it's really that simple. And, I mean, it chokes me up to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never quite said it that way before, but that's true. There were certainly many pressures on her to do something alternative, whatever that would be. Not have me, give me up for adoption. These were very real choices that were discussed and that she was pressured to consider. But it was really her friends, and their two friends who are in the film, I'm pleased to say, because that they agreed to do this, to talk about these events, which were very, very difficult. And they really encouraged her, and they said, listen, if you want to have this baby, you go ahead, do it. And it's a marvelous scene, because the woman who says it in the film, she has a marvelous sort of Bostonian accent. And she said, well, we never knew what Harriet would really come up with, but in the end it was all right, and here you are, and she loved you, and she loved Lou, and that was the love of her life, and she did the right thing. You know, that's the way she... So she was kind of had this Yankee belief somehow that, you know, that if you work at it and you persevere, it'll be okay.
Oh, and also this belief that this kind of love was actually life-enhancing.
Yes, and that you can't turn your back on that. And I think that my mother clearly was very much in love with my father. I think she expected a different outcome. I know that's in the film. I mean, this is one of the most difficult interviews to do in the film was with my mother. I interviewed her twice. I had to go back. I didn't have the courage the first time to ask her the real questions. And the second time I went back actually alone, without my cameraman. And it was the, you know, I was sort of pushed to do that by my wonderful team, which I want to talk to you about, because they're all women. And they said, Nathaniel, you didn't really get from your mother the truth. You got to go back.
What did they want you to ask about that you hadn't asked?
Well, I think really, I mean, several things. One certainly was really to talk about how my mother felt about my father not following through, you know, not being there for her. And the other was, of course, this story which I've been told since I was a young boy, that my father was going to come and live with us, was going to get a divorce and come and live in our house.
This is what your mother kept telling
Yes,
you.
Yes. And you know, we get to that in a moment, but I think, so my mother, when she decided to have me, it was a very, very difficult time. She left Philadelphia. She went to stay with these friends of hers who took her in. She went and lived in upstate Vermont right after I was born, worked for someone up there, and really for 2 years was away from Philadelphia, and it was away from her family, really sort of in exile. I mean, she calls it the exile years. Mm-hmm. And of course, I have no memory of them. I was a little baby, and I see photographs, and I look perfectly happy. But I did, I have to say, come across a photograph just the other day that would have changed the film if I'd had it. And that was a picture of my father in Vermont holding me.
Oh.
And this is something I didn't know. I didn't know that he showed up there, because I remember meeting my father for the first time. I was three. And my mother had, so clearly I met him before that, but I have no memory of it. But when I was about three, my mother, we were living in Chestnut Hill, my mother set three plates at the table. And she said, your father is coming for dinner. And I said, well, what's that? You know, truly not knowing that quite what a father was and that I had one. And I remember him coming for dinner, and it was quite awkward, because it was probably one of the first times that he was aware that I was aware that he was something to me that wasn't quite worked out. And I'll never forget his look. He was very serious. And later when I knew him better, he was, you know, a heck of a lot of fun. But at that time he was awkward. He didn't really know quite what to do, what was expected of him, what he was, you know, other than have dinner with us, what was expected. So my mother went through a lot, and I think one of the things that she held on to through all those years was that he would get a divorce and come and live with us. So I think that's and that he really planned to do that. And that was kind of a story that my mother and I held on to together.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nathaniel Kahn, and his new film is a documentary called My Architect, about his late father, the architect Louis Kahn. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nathaniel Kahn. His new documentary, My Architect, is about his late father, Louis Kahn. Now, Louis Kahn actually had two secret families, or semi-secret. Louis Kahn was married and had a child in that marriage, but there were also two other women in the city of Philadelphia who bore his children, and one of them is the mother of my guest, Nathaniel Kahn. Nathaniel Kahn knew his father, but his father would maybe stop by about once a week to the house. Let's talk a little bit about your father's architecture. Now, he didn't really come into his own as an architect till he was about 50, which is pretty late in life.
Yes.
And he died at the age of 73, so he didn't have like a whole lot of time to really do work once he found himself.
Mm-hmm.
You say in the film it was apparently a trip to Italy and then to other parts of the world where there was truly ancient architecture,
mm-hmm,
that helped him find his style and his voice as an architect. And once he found it, he really worked like a demon.
Yes.
There seems to be an upside and a downside of that.
Mm-hmm.
Upside is the work.
Mm-hmm.
Downside is you talk to some of the people who worked with him, and you get several interesting stories about how difficult it was to work with him because he was so driven.
Yes. That's true. He was very driven. I think it was also an enormously, his office, which I also want to say that He visited us probably once a week, but I also spent time in his office as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my mother, of course, worked for him too, worked with him.
You must have thought a lot about how difficult, like what a strain it must have been for your mother to work at the firm with your father, knowing that he was married to somebody else.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very aware of it.
How did she deal with that?
You'd have to ask her. I mean, it's actually in the film. I do talk about it in the film with her, because she had a little room kind of downstairs, and she was, kind of hidden in the office, because sometimes, you know, his wife would, his wife Esther, who was very formidable, interesting woman, would come through the office, and, Harriet would be there. My mother would be there, and she'd lock herself in the room, you know. So it was a very awkward thing, and I think it was awkward for people in the office. It was certainly awkward for my mother. It was awkward for his wife. It was awkward for Lou. You know, it was awkward for everybody. But this was just kind of, once again, this goes with the territory in a way of somebody who is, I mean, I think of my father as somebody who would burn the furniture to keep the place warm. I mean, he's like one of those characters, you know. It doesn't matter. You can't take it with you.
Right.
So it was a race, you know, and so you don't resolve everything. You just keep going day after day after day.
As you've said, your father was influenced very deeply by ancient architecture that still remains.
Yes.
And he tried to use elements of that in his design,
mm-hmm.
and to get some of the spirituality that architecture had, and put that in his design as well. And the kind of crowning achievement of that in your father's work is the capital of Bangladesh in Dhaka.
Yeah.
You travel there, mm-hmm. for your movie, and I wasn't aware of this till seeing your film. It's a really magnificent, inspiring building, which I'm going to ask you to try to describe.
Sure. Well, I have actually in my pocket here, of course, this is radio, so you can't see it, but I can describe it. Oh, I haven't got it today. I always carry it with me. I washed my wall the other day. So, but it's a his building, the capital of Bangladesh, is on the Bangladeshi money, as we put the White House on the back of our $20 bill, or the capital. I think it's on the 50. I haven't seen a 50 in a while. It is a phenomenal building. He built them a capital that is like nothing else in the whole world. It's a little bit hard to describe as a building because it looks both like it could have landed from space and that it's always been there, that it could have been built yesterday or it could have been built 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. It has an absolute timeless quality. It looks a little like a castle. It's floating in water, a moat that he dug around it, and then it's on a kind of a little rise in the middle. It's made of concrete, but it's not. It doesn't have that kind of heavy, Soviet look at all. It's a very soaring building as well. It's mysterious. You see it in the mist. It looks like it, you know, just landed from outer space, as I said. It has great cutout holes in it that allow light into the interior.
Geometric forms, circles, triangles.
Yep, geometric forms, but they're there for a reason. They're there to let light. I mean, one of the things that my father really hated, he didn't like glass because glass is it's not structure. It's not holding the building up. So the building looks like a ruin and yet also like something modern at the same time. And it has this kind of primitive power.
So what was it like for you the first time you laid eyes on the building?
When I first saw it, it was interesting. You know, it occurs towards the end of the film. We travel throughout the world looking for people who knew my father, seeing his buildings, finding these enormously emotional moments of a son looking for a father. And suddenly I got to Bangladesh and I knew this is the last building of my father's that I'll ever see for the first time. And I wanted to see it right. So we had a guide there, and I said, listen, I don't want to see it out of the side window or something. I really want to see this building because it's so massive and beautiful. So I said, blindfold me. So he did. Blindfolded me. We drove through the streets. You could hear all the tremendous noise of Dhaka. It's a city of many, many millions with absolutely no infrastructure. So we arrived in front of this building. I didn't know quite where we were. Got out of the car, and I started walking across the street. He was guiding me, of course. And then the grass, I felt grass under my feet. The ground was soft. And this silence started to kind of fold around me. The city was sort of receding. And I could feel this presence in front of me. And he said, are you ready? See this thing? And I said, not quite. I just sat and took it in. And then I said, I'm ready. And he took the blindfold off my eyes. And I burst into tears when I saw that building, knowing that it's the last building that I would ever see of my father's for the first time, and realizing the enormity of that achievement in the middle of this extremely poor country. It was at that time a new country. In fact, it was started when it was still Pakistan. The war intervened, buildings stopped. Lou kept working here without being paid in Philadelphia, slaving away on this capital that he knew he had to build and give these people. And here it was, finished 10 years after his death. A monumental achievement, and the capital of a country, a national symbol. Everything he believed architecture could do, that building does.
One of the things that amazes me about this is that this masterpiece that he designed, that he was working on when you had a relationship, when he was still alive, mm-hmm. Was so out of sight. It was so like far removed from anything you could fathom
of
or
course.
See.
Yes.
You know, and so it meant that one of his major obsessions, one of the things that was taking up his time and taking him away from all three of his families, mm-hmm. was something that you couldn't possibly fathom, not only because it wasn't fully built yet, but because it was just so far away.
No, it's true. And he would also often he would tell me stories about India and Bangladesh. He'd sit on the side of my bed, and as a little boy, he'd tell me these fantastic stories about this place, about the Bengal tigers, and about the people there, and about the spirituality, and about a little boy named Rumi, and an elephant named Tubby, and, you know, fantastic stories, and about these men building this huge structure, carrying all the concrete in baskets on their heads with bamboo scaffolding, right? It was phenomenal, fantastical. And you know how oftentimes you hear a story as a child, and then you go see the place, and you think, oh, that's all, you know? That's yeah, sort of disappointing. Everything he said in his stories to me as a little boy was true when I saw that building. And it's so interesting that somehow if you create a project that has kind of an emotional weight to it and a need to be, which is the way Lou would put it, if it really needs to be, and you get people involved with you in it, you can really move mountains together. And I think that's something that I realized too about, it gave me insight on my father. That somehow, by biting off way more than he could chew, which is absolutely what I did with this film, things came to him that you never could have put in place had you been more cautious, you know.
Nathaniel Kahn's new documentary, My Architect, will open next week in New York and Philadelphia. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Given Up for Dead, America's Heroic Stand at Wake Island by Bill Sloan. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with filmmaker Nathaniel Kahn. We talk to photographer Joel Meyerowitz about his new book, Tuscany. And rock critic Ken Tucker checks out what Raoul Malo has been up to lately. His band, The Mavericks, has released its first album in 5 years, and he's co-written an album with country singer Rick Trevino. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Nathaniel Kahn. His new documentary, My Architect, is about his late father, the renowned architect Louis Kahn. The film is about his father's professional achievements and his secret life. In addition to the child Louis Kahn had with his wife Esther, he had two children out of wedlock with women he worked with. Nathaniel's mother Harriet was one of those women. Kahn's two secret families were not mentioned in the obituaries. In fact, Esther apparently didn't want them at the funeral, but they showed up anyways. That's an issue that Nathaniel talks about in the film with Sue Ann Kahn, the daughter of Louis Kahn and his wife Esther. Nathaniel's other half-sister, Alexandra Ting, was in on the conversation, too.
The casket was there, and I remember being, there was some arms went in front of us, and we were pushed into the side room.
You were very, I remember your being mm-hmm. in the side, yeah, because I had a search for you, and I went deliberately to Harriet to say something, because I had never met you, and I knew whoever you are, you must be suffering in some way. And she just, I said, hello, Harriet. She stared straight ahead. And she didn't have anything to do with me. And I felt really bad about that because I went up with the best of intentions to say, look, I'm not my mother or I'm not.
You're not. You know.
You're not.
Had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. you know, on the other hand, I hadn't really made contact with her since you were born. And I felt badly about that, but I knew I couldn't have handled it.
What do you know about the circumstances behind your father's death?
Well, you know, his death was so, it's sort of an irony beyond ironies, right? He was returning from India, from these major projects. He has two major projects in India. He traveled alone. Why, I have no idea. I mean, who does that these days, you know, over that kind of great distances? He was coming back from India. He met someone he actually met another architect, Stanley Tigerman, in London. And I think Lou knew he was going to die. Because of what some things he said to this other architect. He came back to New York. He went through the train station. He wasn't able to get a flight back to Philadelphia. Went to Penn Station, New York, around 8:30 on the night of March 17th, 1974, St. Patrick's Day, Sunday. It was a Sunday. And someone saw him, actually a Philadelphian, saw him. Not in the in the waiting room, and he said, "I have to excuse myself for a moment." He went to the men's room. He didn't come back, and she thought, "Oh, he wanted to, you know, didn't want to be with us." And he collapsed and died in the men's room. And he was, for some reason, the identification on his passport was not complete. I don't think he had a home address on it. He had, I think, a work address on the passport, or the home address, I had heard, was crossed out. So he was unidentified, you know, or they weren't able to contact anybody who knew him for 3 days. And for 3 days, he lay in the morgue in New York, unclaimed. And people in Philadelphia and slowly around the country and then around the world became panicked. You know, where did he go? He disappeared. He really disappeared from the planet.
How was he finally identified at the morgue?
His wife, Esther Kahn, was called, and they said, we have a man here. And they described him, scars on his face. Mm-hmm. Blue eyes, mm-hmm. about this age, white hair. And she said, I think that's Lou. And she went with another architect, actually a fine architect from New York, together, and they went in the morgue, and there he was.
What was the funeral like for you? It was the first time all three of his families actually met.
The funeral was a completely surreal experience, and someday I'll put it in a feature film, because that's where it belongs. It was like a Bergman film, you know. These families were there. These people who'd worked with him, devastated. The taxi drivers from Philadelphia lined up outside Oliver H. Bear Funeral Home here because he didn't drive. He took taxis. And we have taxi drivers in the film, as you know. But there was a line of taxi drivers to pay their respects. My mother's brother, who had so objected to my birth, showed up. And took a taxi from the airport and said he couldn't believe the impact this man had had on this city. You know, he was impressed for the first time, you know. And we were very much shuttled off to the side. I was in a side room with my mother, and I really couldn't see the casket because we were told not to, my father's wife. I think to some degree, understandably, but it's a tragedy. Didn't want us as part of the ceremony, nor did she want my other half sister and her mother to be part of the ceremony. I do understand that. It was a tragedy at the time. It was very difficult. It was a complicated thing for all of these people involved. But for me, a little boy, I just saw kind of the big black suits in front of me, and I really couldn't get close to my father. And it was like I lost him completely, you know. And to see the pallbearers lift him on their shoulders and take him down, it was raining, and I did not go to the graveside. So I never, his death was surreal to me, and I did not believe he was dead. I mean, I did and I didn't, you know. But for years, I would walk around the streets of Philadelphia, and I'd see a white-haired man from the back, and I'd think, that's Lou. He's still around. And when I went to India, it always occurred to me that maybe he decided, you know, enough with all this complication. I want to disappear into the outback. And somehow I did feel that he was, he was there in India and in Bangladesh. And it's interesting. We shot a whole scene at the graveyard, at his gravesite. And I hadn't been there before. It was the first time I went there. You'd think, got to have that scene in the movie. And I had difficulty finding the grave. It was very funny. You know, there was all kinds of stuff going on. And when I looked at it, I said, you know what? The problem is he's not here. This is not where I go to pay my respects to my father. And what an interesting thing to have a father who left not a tombstone, but stones upon stones. I mean, these phenomenal structures. You go to those buildings, his spirit is absolutely there. I felt it. It's there. It's not like a ghost that's wandering around unhappily. It's this sense of the man is right there. You can feel it.
If you could, would you buy one of the homes that he built and live in it?
I would love to buy one of the homes and let my mother live in it. You know, it's not possible for me. I'm a filmmaker. but not for me. No. And I think that's part of why I made the film, because there were so many unresolved things with my father, feelings that I had, a conversation I wanted to have with him for 2 hours. I wanted to grab him out of the grave and say, listen, Daddy, I'm not ready for you to go yet. I got to talk to you. I got to know you before I can let you go. And I think part of that was also realizing that I do have to let him go. And living in a house of his, I think would make me sad all the time.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when you know somebody you care about a lot as a genius,
yes,
you have to ask yourself, do you cut them breaks because they're a genius?
Sure.
Because they're a genius, do they not have to do the dishes? Because they're a genius, do they not have to pay a lot of attention to their children? Because they're a genius, do they not have to hold up their share of whatever it is outside of their official work? And you're kind of in that mix there. You're one of the things that the genius couldn't pay that much attention to.
Sure.
Because he was busy being a genius and busy being very eccentric. In his own way.
Well, so, you know, first of all, I'm not sure my father was a genius, which is an interesting. An interesting kind of question there.
Was he just obsessive and not a genius?
No. I mean, he had tremendous gifts.
Right. Yeah.
But I think one of the lessons of Lou is that if you really, as I said before, if you really bet on yourself,
right,
and you really say, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to use my talents to their best possible.
Right.
Advantage, and you get to live long enough. I mean, part of it is rolling the dice, right?
Right.
I think the story of Lou tells you something will come out. And I don't think it was, you know, he was not one of these people. He wasn't like Mozart or, you know, these people who just, it just flows out of them. He struggled like hell to get these things. And I think you look at some of the buildings that he was halfway towards building, if they'd been built before he was really done, they wouldn't be great. And in a way, what he was his own best critic.
Nathaniel Kahn, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Kahn's new documentary, My Architect, about his late father, Louis Kahn, will open next week in New York and Philadelphia and will open in more cities in the next few weeks. Coming up, photographing the beauty of Tuscany after shooting the hell of Ground Zero. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. After September 11th, my guest, photographer Joel Marowitz, got special permission to be at Ground Zero, documenting the slow process of removing the World Trade Center's remains. After several weeks, he returned to the project he was supposed to be working on, photographing Tuscany, whose natural beauty was the ultimate contrast to the hellish landscape he had been immersed in. His book, Tuscany, Inside the Light, has just been published. The text is by his wife, Maggie Barrett. They were married in Tuscany shortly before September 11th. Marowitz was contractually obligated to go to Tuscany and finish his photography book. Nevertheless, I wondered if he felt almost guilty for leaving behind New York and Ground Zero.
It was wrenching. I have to say that I would be away in Tuscany and I would be thinking about, what am I missing? They're still working down there. And you know, I had become so much part of the rhythm of that place. But I did leave the first time in January, at a point when there was a kind of plateau. They had cleared away most of the surface debris and were beginning to go below ground level. And there was a sense that, you know, they were mining. And I just knew that I could leave for that period of time and it wouldn't be so far advanced when I returned that I would feel I had missed a huge period in the work. And I was right. I came back and I stepped right into it, and it felt, you know, the familiarity of returning to someplace you know well, and suddenly I was in it again, and I didn't feel I missed anything major.
People who go to Italy often come back talking about the light. What do you have to say about the light in Tuscany and how it changes from season to season and from sunshine to rain? What are some of the qualities you're working with?
This place is, well, like every place in the world, unique to itself. But why it's unique came to us after a number of years of observation. This particular valley, called the Val d'Orcia, which is below Siena, is composed of a kind of white clay. Oddly enough, it's an incredibly nourishing clay. Things grow there phenomenally. Wine, olives, wheat, sunflowers. It's a rich land, but it's got a white base to it. It's not black earth or rich American earth. And so when the light rains down in this valley, and because it's a valley, there's a particular kind of moisture always trapped in it. So the valley itself has a kind of pearlescent quality. It's as if the air in the valley is illuminated from within because sunlight striking the ground rises up from the ground. It doesn't suck up the light because of dark earth. So there's a funny kind of glow around everything. And we became aware of this, and it infused the photographs that not only I made, but my students made. And so it began to suggest itself to us as a very unique phenomenon in this particular location on the face of the globe.
And how does that glow get affected by changes in the weather and changes in the season?
Well, in the wintertime, the valley is one of those places that holds the moisture longer than any place else. So when you awake in the morning, there's always fog, which could be dismal if you're living in Norway. But in Tuscany, even in the winter, there's sunlight. And so it penetrates this fog, and then it raises it. So you have the changing of the day every day. And I felt that the wintertime was almost the most exciting season of the year.
Joel, one of the books you're well known for is about Cape Cod, and particularly about the light in Cape Cod. How would you compare Cape Cod light with the light in Tuscany?
Well, oddly, they're completely different, but they share some wonderful qualities. Of course, Cape Cod is a spit of sand, also light-colored, surrounded by water. So there's always a kind of an atmospheric moisture that rises off the surface of the water, sort of cooked by sunlight, and it splinters the light almost prismatically. That was my sense of what it was like to be on the Cape, that there was a kind of purity to the way light fell. When you're on the mainland, inland anywhere, there's always particles of dirt in the air, whether it's pollution or dust, who knows. But those particles, if you think of a little drop of dust in every molecule of moisture, it reduces the light somewhat. But in Cape Cod, there's no landmass to speak of. And so the air seems to be purer, more glowing. And so there was a kind of radiance. I used to say it was almost shadowless, is how it felt. So the Cape has its glow from the waters around it, and the Val d'Orcia has its glow from its substance, what it's made of, this clay which is good enough to be made into pottery. So it has a kind of glass-like reflectance to it.
There's a certain type of beauty that I think has almost been, well, ruined might be too strong a word, but there's a certain type of picture or picture postcard that captures this, like, perfect scene, and we've come to think of it as scenery, or as, like, it's like a picture postcard. And as lovely as it is, it's predictable and cliched. Do you feel that, Joel, as a photographer, there's a certain type of image that's kind of been ruined for you by that type of perfect image or perfect scenery? And how do you try to get something that goes deeper than that?
You're absolutely right. The wallpaper that Tuscany has become is sort of there by the yard. Almost any photographer can stand anywhere in Tuscany in the countryside and point their camera and clip off 70 degrees worth, you know, with a 35-millimeter lens, and you have Tuscany. And if you put into it cypress trees on a hilltop with a church nearby, or, you know, charming sheep on the road below, you can make something that everybody has seen in the postcards. So part of the challenge was to avoid those things that we all know already, that have ruined the experience for us, and try to get into a place where the surprise, the freshness, the innocence of observation could make its way. And so I avoided things like the fields of sunflowers and all of these lollipop trees. And then one day, towards the end of our work, in the fall actually, we were driving through a valley, and there was fields of sunflowers, all of them heads bowed, brown-stalked, drooping flowers, and it looked like the dead marching off the battlefield. And I stopped the car, we both gasped, and got out and stood amongst them. And what I felt was that they had served their day. They are now going to be turned into useful produce. And they were a kind of a vast horde that was accepting their death. The season had brought them to this. And I made a photograph that, to me, is one of the darkest and maybe even most daring pictures in the book, because it's anti-beauty. It isn't about the familiar gloss that sunflowers make. It's about the reality of the life cycle. And I think often, for me, photography isn't about making a frame. It's about having a moment when I wake up, where I think, oh my God, this is happening right in front of me. And that kind of awareness, that kind of mental process, is for me where the ideas of photography and the act of photography combine in a way and perhaps allow us to make something new.
Photographer Joel Marowitz. His new book is called Tuscany, Inside the Light. The text is by Maggie Barrett. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new projects involving Raoul Mallow of the Mavericks. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The Mavericks have put out their first album in 5 years, and lead singer Raul Malo has just produced and co-written an album with the country singer Rick Trevino. Taken together, says rock critic Ken Tucker, these two projects show the range of Malo's Mexican-American take on country, pop, and rock music.
That big booming voice with a conversational intimacy, it's Raul Malo's pipes that makes the Mavericks instantly identifiable to any listener whose first reaction isn't, "Hey, is that Roy Orbison?" Certainly on this album called simply The Mavericks, Malo isn't shying away from the Orbison comparisons with soaring ballads like In My Dreams.
I used to think I was the only
Meanwhile, Rick Trevino turned to Raul Malo to jumpstart his career. Dumped by Columbia Records as a straight-down-the-middle country crooner, Trevino is using his debut on Warner Brothers Records and his songwriting collaborations with Malo to give his music a more open, wide-ranging sound. It results in juicier music even when he's singing about so hackneyed a subject as how hard it is to be a star.
I'll be drinking cold coffee at a diner in Baton Rouge. I got a show there out of nowhere. Then we gotta drive straight on through to Oklahoma and Arizona. What's 1,000 miles or two for a big star in an old car? This is all a dream come true.
There are times on this album, such as the title song, In My Dreams, when Trevino sounds more like the old Mavericks than the current Mavericks do. Listen to the way his vocal attack echoes Malo's here.
I used to think I was the only one who never knew what it was like to fall. Came along and changed all the rules that day. And just for a moment, I had it all. You are the dream.
On the whole, and with the exception of a misguided cover of Bryan Adams' soppy Have You Ever Really Loved a Woman, Trevino's work with Malo is tighter and more cohesive than the Mavericks album, which tends to sprawl and repeat itself. By now, it's too easy for Malo to power ballad his way through a song. He's much better with a lighter touch, such as he applies to the swinging Shine a Light.
I really want to sit and talk about the way things are, maybe ought to be. It's wisdom I don't want to do without. Brother, shine your light on me. Shine your light on me. I've never been a real religious man, but I only see as far as my eyes can see. So what exactly is the promised land? Brother, shine your light on me.
I don't think either the Mavericks or Trevino are going to make any new commercial breakthroughs with these albums. They're at once too idiosyncratic and too traditionalist. But that doesn't mean Mahlo and Trevino can't, every so often, reach into your heart and give it just the right sort of tug.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Heartaches will find you every time you slip on over that cheating line. Heartaches are faithful when love is blind. When I look at you, darling, is it true? Heartache, are you gonna be mine? I hate the way that you make me feel each time you walk through that door. But when the hurting's gone, you come along, and I keep coming back for more. Heartaches will find you every time you slip on over that cheating line. Heartaches are faithful when love is blind. When I look at you, darling, it's true. Heartache, are you gonna be mine? Yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence James and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young at bookstores everywhere. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Nan A. Talese's Doubleday, publishers of Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter by author Thomas Cahill, available at bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, disco diva Donna Summer. She has a new memoir called Ordinary Girl. And we talk with Sean Penn. He's starring in Mystic River, and his next film, 21 Grams, is about to open. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.